Alfred Hitchcock, when a tightrope walker gets right out there in the middle and starts standing on his head, what percentage of the crowd in the circus secretly hopes he'll fall?
I would say about 1%.
Just about one.
Mm.
There's a new law in New York State that demands a net underneath the high wire.
Mm-hmm.
Does that spoil the act?
Completely. Completely.
There are two kinds of onlookers in the world. Those who are sorry there's a net, and those who are glad it's there. Which one are you?
I'm sorry there's a net. If you know there is a net, what's the good of him doing the thing at all?
All right. Freedom from fear is a great battle cry for politicians. But if people really wanted freedom from fear, why would they pay good money to get shocked out of their wits? This is Barry Farber, and the man who's won the right to answer that question ahead of everybody else in the world is across the microphone right now. He's Alfred Hitchcock. He's the high priest of panic, and he makes his living commuting from terror to suspense to laughter, and he's taken the whole world with him through 50 movies, and they've all lived up to Hitchcock's high standard of horror. But I want to find out if Mr. Hitchcock can remember his most terrifying moment in real life. We'll get underway with the director whose favorite applause is the human shudder. If Alfred Hitchcock were ever president of the United States, we might hear him say on Inauguration Day that we have nothing to fear but the absence of fear. Because for his past 50 movies, he's proven that fear is not only fun, but financially fruitful. Mr. Hitchcock, explain what you mean when you say that fear can be enjoyable.
Well, we have to go way back, Barry, to the little baby in its mother's arms. I would say about 3 months old would be the figure. And for some inexplicable reason, the mother holding the baby and enjoying the baby and to the fullest suddenly says to it, "Boo!" The poor baby gets the hiccups and takes on a look of fear, and suddenly the baby smiles and the mother is as pleased as anything. So the baby enjoyed fear for the first time. The hiccups were soon over, and in a moment she was doing it again. Now this little baby didn't know it, but what was being brought out of it was the pleasure of fear.
Well, now, of course, a housewife can be a Hitchcock in her own household if she knows how to trigger hiccups. But when the child gets a little bit older, how about when he sees cars speeding down the freeway and he knows that if he gets hit, he's not going to smile and give his mother a big laugh?
He, long before he gets to the cars on the freeway, he gets on a swing and swings higher and higher until he gets so high that the thing nearly turns over and he stops it. He goes on till he scares himself.
Do you enjoy fear? Did you enjoy the fear that you experienced in London during the Blitz?
No. If you were going to say, when was I most frightened? I think in World War I, sitting in a passageway in a house in London with the racket going on outside and the bombs dropping. And there I felt terrified because of the helplessness of the situation. You see, a soldier in battle is too busy going about his own business to worry about the things coming at him. That's why I've seen, I remember in the First World War, soldiers were more scared than civilians.
Because?
Of the helplessness.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Standing there and waiting.
Well, the audience at a horror movie, at a Hitchcock movie,
right,
knows that it's insulated from the fear.
Right.
Even if the worst happens to the people they like on screen, it's not going to hurt them. Do you think that we like our fear as long as it can't really hurt, like the swing or the roller coaster?
I think what we do temporarily we transfer ourselves to the situation, and subconsciously, somehow, we know that we can turn it off, get up, go out of the theater. But while we're transferring ourselves to that thing up there, for example, I'll give you a thing. I can't bear cruelty to animals of any kind. I get terribly upset. In fact, there was one movie where they were doing things to horses. I had to get up and go out.
Can you explain the difference between terror and suspense, and which one do you prefer to whiplash the audience with?
Terror is, I would say, less in the mind of the audience than suspense is. You see, if you remember a movie, Psycho, here you had a very violent killing in a bathtub, in a bathroom, you know. As the film went on, this was designed, this picture, to transfer the terror which you saw visually on the screen into suspense, which was transferring the thing to the mind of the audience. As that film went on, the physical thing got less and less. I was transferring it into the mind of the audience.
You wrote a magazine article one time that used a different example. You were talking about a secret rendezvous between two lovers. Now, if the husband is in Detroit, see, mm-hmm. and the two of them are rendezvousing in some little alcove somewhere, and the husband, open, who's supposed to be in Detroit, suddenly throws the door open and stands there with a gun,
mm-hmm.
that's terror.
That's a surprise. That's shock.
But if you wanted to blend that into suspense.
Very different thing. All you do, give the audience more information. Show, long before the confrontation takes place, that the husband is on his way. So the audience are saying to the couple in the alcove, get out, get out. He's on his way.
And the audience knows something.
More than the character.
More than each one.
Take our little simple. This is, I've repeated many times, but I'll give it to you again. You and I are sitting here, and in 10 minutes after our conversation through, just on the 9.5 minutes, nobody knows it, but there's been a bomb under this table, and we're blown up, sky high. What do the audience get? Shock. 10 seconds of shock. Supposing we do the same scene, but we tell the audience there's a bomb at the beginning of our conversation. And we tell them that the clock up there will tell them it's going to go off at 1:05. There's pure suspense. I would much rather have 10 minutes of suspense instead of 10 seconds of shock, because the 9 minutes leading up to it, the audience have nothing. They're listening to a very, probably a dull conversation. That same conversation, when they have knowledge of the bomb, they're saying, don't talk all that silly nonsense. Get out of there. But another factor, very important, that bomb must never kill us. That audience are in great sympathy with us, and they urge us to get out of that room before that bomb goes off. And I once, in a movie, had this situation, and the bomb did go off.
That was the little boy.
And
the
biggest mistake I ever made.
And the
woman
lonely,
alone.
The woman alone.
That's
right. The
Sylvia
little boy
Sydney.
Had this bomb.
Right.
And the audience knew it, and he didn't. And you let it blow up on him.
Right. Biggest mistake I ever made.
Did the audience ever forgive you?
Never, because I let them down. You see, they were furious with me. They've got to be relieved. You cannot suspend them all that time and not relieve them. In other words, what we have to do in the little scene we've just described, your foot kicks something. We look under. What is it? Oh, there's a parcel here. Now, they know what it is. Well, I wonder what it is. Well, let's undo it and see. Now they're saying, hurry up and undo it. And I can't. Let's get a knife. I don't know. We'll go out in the kitchen and get a knife. Where do you keep your knives here? We both move out of the. As we get to the door, the thing goes up. But we're safe. Then they're satisfied.
Now, you let Janet Leigh get hacked to ribbons in a motel bathroom
mm-hmm.
in Psycho.
Right.
What principle were you working on there?
That was a complete leading the audience up the garden deliberately, because we start off with a story about a girl stealing $40,000 without a sign there's going to be anything happening to her. In fact, this thing comes out of left field, this killing.
That was your shock that gave you a passport to more suspense.
That is right. That is right.
You never let terror strike from a sinister castle in Transylvania. You prefer it lunging out of a motel bathroom or out of a familiar bar in the hotel plaza or from the delegates' lounge in the United Nations where a knife zips across the room into somebody's back. You like the horror to come out of the ordinary.
Definitely, oh yes. Everything, you know, there's more realism, per se, in these fantasies that I make than there is in the average story, because it's a must. I've got to make the audience believe what is going on up there is true at the moment, at the time. They can debate it when they get home, but while they're sitting there in that movie house, it's got to be real, everything.
You sort of lulled into a false sense of security because you're in ordinary surroundings, a used car lot, here's a drugstore, there's a supermarket, you figure nothing can happen here, and then...
That's right, then things do happen. Now, you see, I have a specific rule, and that is, if you have a background, say if you talk about if I have a drugstore, that's got to be involved in the story. You see, that must be used. Not do anything against any background. They've got to be integrated.
There was a little theater in Paris which was completely non-Hitchcockian in its concept of horror. I mean, they used the masks and the blood-curdling screech.
You know, the Grand Guignol?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And they, you know, skeletons and
yes,
heads rolling across the stage. Things you would never do.
Never.
Far beneath your standards of horror.
No.
But they closed. They closed this past year because they said that people can't be horrified anymore because nothing on stage could be more horrifying than the headlines. Did that ever discourage you?
No. I'm always fighting headlines, after all. Supposing I had an idea to do a film about the leader, one of the leaders of a big state in the middle of the war decides to fly over to the enemy and have a chat. The Hess case. They say, you're crazy. That's where headlines take it away from us. It happens all the time.
Call the roll on some of the stars, the big stars you've slaughtered on screen. Let's see, there's Grace Kelly, Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant, Laurence Olivier.
Stewart.
Yep, Jimmy Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think people prefer to see the big ones cut up?
If you walk along Broadway now and you see a street accident, you take a look, poor fellow, been knocked down by a taxi. You go on your way. Take a second look, it's your brother. Think of the difference in the emotion. Well, that's the same thing with what happens to the hero. If it's a known star, the story takes on a greater strength than it does if it's an unknown person.
Mr. Hitchcock, the birds starts off with a practical joke. Now, a lot of people suspect that you enjoy a good practical joke more than a box office success, and they're harder to stage sometimes. It's impossible to bring a practical joke back to life. You have to be there at ground zero when it happens, but some of the things you've done, for instance, are like send a friend 400 smoked herring on his birthday. You've given parties, and big parties in small rooms with rude waiters. You had an old horse delivered during a performance to the late Sir Gerald de Maurier's dressing room in St. James Theater, and you provided for huge pieces of furniture to be installed as Christmas gifts in small apartments of your colleagues. The practical joke that I like the best, and I've tried to use it myself, I'm not as good as you are at it, but I'm getting there. I'm talking about the kind of conversations you used to have in the elevator with Joseph Cotton at the St. Regis.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you explain
that? Oh, yes, I can. You get in, you need 18 floors to do this little gag, you see. And the elevator is full of people. And I usually get in with my wife, and then I start the conversation as I get in the elevator. And I say, well, I didn't know the gun was loaded. The thing went off and tore a gaping hole in the side of his neck. And it must have been a dum-dum bullet or something, because a flap of the flesh fell down, and it revealed all the white ligaments showing. And all of a sudden, I felt my feet terribly wet. And when I looked down, there I was standing in a pool of blood, and he fell down. And by this time, we're at the ground floor, and I just get out and carry on. I did it once, and a woman got down as far as the second floor and said, "Let me get out. Please let me get out," to the elevator boy.
Yes. Great. Absolutely great, particularly in New York. You know, you pull that in my hometown in Greensboro, North Carolina, everybody would mob you, cluster around you, get in the taxi cab with you until they heard the end of it. Mm. But here, New Yorkers become prisoners of their own reserve.
I once left them all standing. When I got in with my wife, I said, "Do you know, she married 4 times and had a child by each husband. And one day the 4 children met. And what do you think they said to each other?" That's all I got out of the elevator.
Tremendous.
Left them standing.
We're spending the night pinpointing the principles of panic with Alfred Hitchcock, who invented those principles, and he practices them in public in movies like Psycho, Vertigo, North by Northwest, 39 Steps, Notorious, The Paradine Case, Dial M for Murder, at least 50 others, including The Birds, and that stars Tippi Hedren, and this is her first role, and it's the starring role in The Birds. Is this the first time you've selected a star on impulse?
I wouldn't say it's entirely impulse. I felt when I saw this little flash of her on the television screen that she had something. Now, I didn't see it once. This was a commercial that came on an early morning show, and I used to come on every other morning. So naturally, it's a news show, and one used to turn this on while having early morning tea in bed, about 7:30. So I got a chance to look at this girl probably a half a dozen times, and it had an effect on me that I thought, well, I better send for her, which I did. I didn't bother to see her. I was content with what I saw on the screen. And I had my assistants and people interview her, and I said, "What's she like?" And she seemed very bright. And so I said, "Okay, we'll sign her up." Then I met her, and I went to work. The big trick was she going to be able to read lines? And she came up very well.
I understand that you gave her the most expensive screen test in the history of Hollywood.
Well, I believe this. I don't see how you can just put a girl in front of a newsreel camera almost and smack one light on her and talk to her and ask her a series of questions, and that's a test. I believe that it must be done just as though it were full production. The top cameraman, a top actor, a top wardrobe. You must see them at their best.
I think she had the best screen test possible. She just caught your attention from out of a TV commercial.
That's right, yeah.
Can't get a better head start than that.
No.
When you walk across the screen in your movies, I mean, everybody knows you do, and I find myself at times paying more attention looking for you than I do following the plot.
That is why I get rid of it in the first shot in the picture.
So that everybody can quit looking and relax.
Quit looking and get on. He's gone, and that's enough.
Now, I can see how you got in on The Lodger and The Case of Lady Camber and The Girl Was Young and The 39 Steps, which is my wife's favorite movie. Mm-hmm. She saw it in Sweden when she was a little girl and almost decided never to leave Sweden because she didn't want to be any place where anything like that could go on. I can see how you get in and out of these movies. But how did you tackle Lifeboat? Because that was all in the middle of the ocean.
Well, I just devised a little newspaper ad read by one of the characters, an old newspaper he had with him, and there in this ad is a product called Reduso, and it showed me before and after.
Incidentally, are you sensitive about the fact that you lost 100 pounds? I think
no,
it's inspiring.
I was very glad to do it. I'm in the middle of losing more. I got down to about another 25 off in the last month or 5 weeks, but coming to New York, slurred it up a bit.
Let's get a little bit clinical. How did you do it? There are a lot of people out there who would like to lose weight. Was it hard? Did it take willpower?
It takes willpower, and there's only one thing that takes off weight. Cut down the intake. You can read all the books you like. You're going to have all the fad diets you like. I tried an experiment which I'd often thought about but never put it into practice, is not eating at night or eating the absolute minimum, because that's the meal you go to bed on. That's the meal you do not work off. The breakfast and lunch you work off, but that one you don't.
I wish you'd write a book on that someday. That'd be the one Alfred Hitchcock story with a happy ending for everybody.
Well, you know, even when you look at these old diets like lamb chops and pineapple, why, one slice of pineapple is only 50 calories anyway, and each lamb chop's 100 calories. So you've got 250 calories. People think it's a combination of the pineapple and the lamb. Nothing at all.
We spend a lot of time arguing whether it's easier to make Americans laugh or Englishmen. Who is it easier to make horrified?
I think it's the same the world over. I'm very conscious of the fact that if I'm devising a picture by the use of film, emotion, I want that emotion to affect the Japanese, the Germans, everyone, at the same time if necessary, the world over.
The Portuguese sabotaged you. They took Psycho. And when they threw away the title Psycho, and they gave it another title, The Boy Who Masqueraded as His Mother, which, of course, gave away the whole film.
Yes. Well, you get those things.
I've gone into your background a little bit because I wanted to see what I thought would be your most terrifying moment out of real life, and you mm-hmm. surprised me. You went back to World War I.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was going to be over Atlanta, Georgia, when the mayor...
Oh, yes, I was scared then. That's true. And, of course, I was really scared. And we had a reporter in the plane with us because we kept, you know, we were going there for the anniversary of Gone with the Wind. Olivier, Vivian Lee, myself were the three people going there. And the mayor was down below, you know, get it down, get the plane down. We've got 3,000 people waiting here, searchlights going around. I could see them on the underside of the cloud. Kept diving down. He could never make it. And I said, let's get out of here. Let's go back to Memphis, Tennessee, wherever our last place we got on, or Louisville. I can't remember where it was. Anyway, and the funny thing, this sounded awful panicky. And the following morning, I read the account in the Atlanta paper, and it was all attributed to Olivier. It made him look awful.
I know. You came out as the hero of that. You
yes.
You were the cucumber on board who said, relax, you know, break out a deck of cards. You won that one, what?
Oh, yes.
Mr. Hitchcock, have you ever thought how you would go about constructing the end of the world in sight and sound on screen?
I would say that... if I were treating it subjectively, it could only be a flash, because it would be from the point of view of an individual. I had a dream once. I can't remember where I was. I think it was in the studio. And there was a blinding flash. And I remember saying to myself, this is it. And then there was nothing more. I was in Senator Dirksen's office in Washington. He had a thing stuck up on the wall, and it said, don't worry, they are only 90 minutes away.
Alfred Hitchcock, he's been called the master of suspense. I don't think that's good enough for him. Let's call him the high priest of panic. This is Barry Farber. Thank you for your attention.